I'm Larkin Kemp.
Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
The boys are back in town. Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello and Larkin Kemp. And we are here to talk about Shedeur Sanders slipping to the fifth round, right? Isn't that what we're here to talk about?
What a day for Twitter. I'll tell you one thing. When sports stories happen, checking the pulse of the sports world, especially when they tie in with everybody's in a conspiracy, everyone's racist, people are blackballing Deion Sanders. Twitter's a great little, you know, they call it a town hall, but it's like a town riot every single day, and it's fantastic. So
there's nothing I wouldn't give to be able to be a fly on the wall and like watch the interview film of Shedeur at the draft. Like the rumors and gossip churning about what he was like in those meetings that led to this free fall are unbelievable.
Well, I lied. We're not here to actually talk about that. We're here to talk about what is probably the best weekend of lacrosse that we've had so far this season. And this podcast is going to be a little bit different because while we like to lean into analyzing the games, unfortunately, we're going to have to do the thing that most sports fans complain about, which is sports media types leaning into narratives, because the storylines that came away from this weekend's set of games were too rich and too robust not to dive into. So if you're here for our core analysis, come back next week. Maybe we've got it for you after the conference tournaments come to a conclusion. But Larkin, we missed you last week. What's your reaction to just how, from a scriptwriter's standpoint, because you worked in sports entertainment prior to joining this podcast, could it have been written any better?
It was one of the best weekends of television I've been around. I mean, from the goals record to, of course, the goal mouth, horrible over-officiating, seemingly in every game. You have the Duke UVA result, everything that went into it. It was just fantastic, almost as if it was written in a lab by Triple H himself. Can't wait to get into it and excited to be here. Like, oh.
All right, before we get going, just want to make sure that you guys remember that the men's and women's NCAA championships are heading back to Gillette Stadium for the first time since 2017, May 23rd to 26th. Nowhere in lacrosse you'd rather be than Foxborough, Massachusetts. 8 of the most impactful games of the season. Friday, women's D1 semifinals, which are coming into clearer focus. Saturday, men's D1 semis. Championship action starts on Sunday with men's D2, men's D3, and women's D1. Might be able to hear some inside lacrosse voices on the call of at least two of those games, culminating Monday afternoon with the men's D1 final. This year, Inside Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off all single-day ticket options by using the code ILPOD at checkout. Head to ncaa.com/laxtickets and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase your tickets. There's actually a flash sale going on right now, which I think you can get better than $5 off. So if you're listening to this, check out the flash sale. If you're listening to this like 2 days after it came out, then go back and insert ILPOD. It's going to be your best deal. So, Larkin, you are an adopted Cornellian, sort of. And we're going to start there because CJ Kirst set the all-time record for goals in a career. This record is now just like basically falling pretty much every year. He snaps Peyton Cormier's, which he broke in the first round of the NCAA tournament last year, with his 225th goal in a 10-8 win over Dartmouth. What are your thoughts? We've spent a lot of time talking about the lefty who's going to be the number one pick in the PLL draft, but what were your thoughts on a record-breaking performance?
Yeah, he's just a remarkable player. I mean, I think what's sad's the wrong term, but I think one of my frustrations with the post-COVID kind of like return to normalcy is that people unfairly like associate the incremental eligibility with, I think, the rate at which some of these records have fallen, right? Specifically when Cormier did it. And frankly, that's probably unfair to him, but also I think it's just because he wasn't a primary like ball-carrying attackman. He wasn't even the best player on his team, right? Because of Schellenberger. But Kirst doing it in the league he did against a very challenging schedule. I think Cornell year in, year out, probably plays like a top 10, 15, 20 SOS. And they were good that entire time, right? It's not as if he was, you know, scoring 8 goals a game on a bad team. Like he's frankly just one of the best players we've seen at this level. I think, you know, for people listening, they should buy tickets to Gillette. They should try and go see him in the tournament or in the Ivy League tournament this weekend.
ILPOD to check out.
Like, he is quite literally perhaps the best lefty to ever play college lacrosse. It's a privilege to watch him go to work. And no different than when we talked about the Ovechkin goals record. I think when Cormier set that, it was a record that many believed would just stand based on his incremental eligibility and the amount of games played. But when Lyle did this, there was real buzz in the air, right? It was like a kind of where were you? Like, you cleared your Saturday calendar to watch Lyle Thompson pick it up off the end line. And CJ Kurz deserves that respect right now. Like, he's just that good. So a huge credit to him, and I hope the boys had a great weekend celebrating.
Nick, a all-time great Cornell attackman making headlines. Would you like to be the first to report that he's going to transfer to Denver?
Yeah, he's either going to Yale, Albany, or Denver, one of the three. Suck at TD. But what I love about, you know, kind of moments like this is, you know, Terry, you alluded to it at the top of the show where, you know, we're pretty dialed in on a week-by-week basis. But when somebody clears this mark like Kurz did, it's a good chance to almost take a step back and not just reflect on the season but on the career. And what I love about Kurz is it's almost difficult to define him because I think about Thompson, I think about Cormier, and there were certain tendencies, and even, you know, Ovi's one-timer or Lyle's backhand or, you know, Cormier's step down from his preferred spot. And what I love about Kurz is the variety in which he's been able to consistently be a great goal scorer. I really feel like of the great goal scorers that I've ever watched, he is the most aggressive in every variety, whether he gets a full head of steam, whether he's playing off ball, whether he's playing a two-man game. Like, the way in which he can completely take over a game is not directly related to any, oh wow, he's really good at this and he just figured out a way to get that repeatedly over and over and over. And, you know, to Larkin's point, it should be appointment viewing every time he picks up a stick for the Big Red from now, you know, until Cornell season wraps up, whether that's, you know, the Monday of Memorial Day or before that. And, you know, if you're a young player, and I constantly try and talk about, hey, who should you watch? Look at the variety in which Kurz has been able to dominate every aspect of the field and aspire to be the quality of teammate he is both on and off the field, and, you know, not afraid to share the ball, not afraid to be the man when the situation calls for it. And, you know, kudos to Kurz and the way that he's done it. He's been a class act from the first day he stepped on campus all the way until breaking records.
So you hit on one of the points that I wanted to reiterate, which is just what he is as a teammate. But there's one other element that I just want to make sure doesn't go unnoticed or unsaid with respect to when you are an attackman and you set a goals record. Some folks that aren't familiar with your game might be predisposed to think that that's what you do and that's all you do. And maybe with Peyton Cormier, that was a little bit of a fair comment. With CJ Kurz, and this is one of the things that I love about, you know, we created this fantasy lacrosse game either 3 or 4 seasons ago, and it distills your entire production, including negative points for turnovers, as well as positive points for ground balls and cause turnovers, into a per game number. And so just for all players, CJ Kurz is the leader at 27.08 fantasy points per game. Number two is Sam King at 24.69. CJ Kurz is averaging nearly a cause turnover per game and nearly 2 ground balls per game. And for an attackman, those are sizable numbers. And so his effect on winning is more than just scoring goals. And it's hard to believe, more than just being a great teammate. It's the impact that he makes all over the field. And it'll be really interesting because Maryland is now number one in RPI. I think that their stranglehold on the number one seed in the NCAA tournament has firmed, I don't even know, has whatever. It's firmer than it was last week when Cornell was number one in the NCAA committee's top 10. And Larkin, you've been right. And it's actually a really good year to be even more focused on the path, right? The quality of the first round matchup. Do you get, you know, one of those 3 first round matchups where you can presume that you're going to be able to take your foot off the gas, maybe take your starters out in the late third, early fourth quarter and reshift your focus into the quarterfinal? Are you going to get a quarterfinal where you're a 2-3 goal favorite, or a quarterfinal where you're a 1-goal favorite? Those are the factors that, you know, that's what we're parsing out when we talk about the path. And, you know, Cornell is now, in my opinion, kind of in that threshold, right? In that 3-4 threshold. I mean, granted, it's been my opinion the entire time, but, you know, Maryland's resume has improved, and I think the Big Red and the Princeton Tigers still have something to play for when it comes to the Ivy League tournament, because, you know, it's very reasonable that only one of those teams is going to get that favorable path, and it's going to go to whoever comes out on top, presuming it's one of them in the Ivy League tournament.
I think that's well said. In particular, this year we have some talent-based sleeping giants that are, like, floating in the at-large traveling bucket. Like, I don't really think that Busick, as an example, wants, like, a Notre Dame or a Syracuse or a Duke, depending on what shakes out at the ACC tournament. So completely aligned, and I think the Ivy League tournament will be important just as a litmus test also of, like, can Cornell do it over, a short turnaround? They're going to be at home. Like, they should realistically pump Yale Friday and then, you know, win by 2 or 3, in my opinion, against Princeton Sunday, just based on the home field advantage alone. But time will tell.
So it is rightful that the all-time goal scoring record being broken leads the podcast. But at the same time, a team beating another team 20 straight times in the regular season, during which that team that they have beaten has won 4 national championships, is not just the most mind-boggling stat in college lacrosse. You'd be hard-pressed to come up with a more mind-boggling stat in all of sports. I mean, Virginia is really good, and they have lost to Duke 20 times in a row in the regular season. Nick, our resident ACC homer, explain it. And then not only that, but also explain the fact that Virginia led by a goal twice in the fourth quarter, and Duke, of course, won in overtime.
And I've tried to wrap my mind around this, and I really have done over from the second that Duke scored in overtime. I've been waiting for this question to be asked, and I am at a complete loss for words. The closest thing that I can get is that, and we've talked about it on the podcast before, but there are matchups in which the players put a much bigger weight, whether the coaches try to go against that. And using an anecdote, we certainly didn't like teams more than other teams, but like me personally, I hated UNC, and I hated them so much that I would actually play worse against them. And we called it the white knuckle effect. You know, when you're gripping your stick so tight because you just really know that you want to win this game more than any other game on the schedule, regardless of importance, and just because it's the matchup that you personally as a player have had circled, not regardless of the fans, the coaches. I would be shocked if Lars wasn't going into this game saying it's just another opponent, let's really just try and focus on playing UVA lacrosse, as he's probably done 19 times in a row prior to this season. So I'm going to say that this is a case of it's almost like the terminal yips, really. And a putt that you've made 15 times in a row, but you have the eyes on you, you have the history of missing this putt, you have the history of losing to Duke. You know, it's white knuckle syndrome that doesn't exist anywhere else outside of this Duke-UVA, if you want to call it a rivalry. I know that we were talking about, oh, you have to win. So the only thing that I can really say about this game is that Virginia's players, not coaching staff, not anything other than Virginia players, are aware, and that's in the back of their mind. And even looking at some of those big moments, when UVA got a shot off in overtime, you know, top center, I can't remember the player who shot it, and it was a great
Griffin Schutz.
Yeah, Griffin Schutz gets a great shot off. The tangible way that the UVA players were ready to celebrate as if there was this huge monkey being lifted off of their back before realizing that it was a goal. Like, they were already ready to celebrate as if they had won the national championship. And then conversely, when Duke won it in overtime, like, the true heartbreak, not just because UVA hasn't had the season that they've wanted, but every single player did the surrender scorpion or sat down. And I think the way that UVA reacted to those two moments, their shot being saved in overtime and then ultimately the goal, proved to me more than anything else about the pace of the game, anything else about, you know, how they blew their lead, that to me proved that this is a white knuckle of white knuckles.
And Larkin, one of the other things that makes this 20-game streak so bizarre is the fact that it's now happened over the course of two Virginia head coaching staffs, and you played for the current one. How do you assume Lars and his group approach this, and you know, do you believe that the mentality has poisoned something in the water in Charlottesville? The mentality of the game, to be clear, not the mentality of the program. Because obviously, like I said,
I think he's gutted for the guys. Like, if you peel back the KPIs, they outground ball Duke at home 46-27. Like, they did the little things yesterday. Man down was 2-for-2. Like, they gave their offense a chance in overtime. You got a former number one overall recruit at like 12 yards hands free. You know, it's one of these game plans where you feel like, you know, as an offense that has struggled all year, like, you were kind of gaining leverage and making good decisions all day. Like, I thought Kevin had a good plan on that side of the ball. I really liked the way Greenspan was grinding at the dot. Like, that's a game you can win. And also, I think it would have just made the bubble conversation compelling, because maybe they go to the ACC tournament and steal another. And at 8-7, are they now like a potential, you know, slot over Harvard if they lose this weekend, right? Like, I think the world was kind of like excited for that. But yeah, just to double down on Nick's point, I think this is one of the craziest streaks in all of sport. I think people need to understand the way lacrosse works and how, you know, based on the familial nature of where these kids come from, they go to the same high schools, like, they hit on the same girls, they go to the same bars in the summer. Like, it is literally insane that the University of Virginia has not been able to beat Duke in the regular season for 20 years. And, you know, for Lars in particular, just based on who he is as a human, it must keep him up quite literally all summer thinking about this. And in particular yesterday, just because of the year they've had. And I think on senior day, it would have been really special, obviously, to get over the hump. So feeling for those guys, feeling for 26, and that whole, you know, the whole senior leadership group there. Because I think even in a down year, it's nice to hang your hat on something. So, yeah.
And Larkin, almost a question out of curiosity. Lars, as a coach, is he cognizant, or does he recognize, like, the weight of a game like this? Or is he more of a, we focus on ourselves and this is just who happens to be the opponent?
I think it's a combination. Like, he definitely, based on just familiarity, right, he's prepped and planned for Donowski and the way in which they coach on both sides of the ball all year intentionally, because, like, ultimately you have to win those games to win the ACC, which is the goal. But I will say, and this is, like, a credit to Lars, when you get down to single elimination lacrosse, like, I don't think there's anyone more well prepared. And Virginia's season was on the ropes a month ago, so I'm assuming the dialogue in that room when they were sitting at whatever it was, 5-7, was, listen, our only chance is to win out. Just extend our year and hope that we can back our way into this thing. Just, you know, obviously because there's not an automatic qualifier in the ACC because there's only five men's lacrosse teams. So, it's just gutting. And listen, let's just state the obvious. This isn't a very good Duke team. Like, Duke is very much in this thing based on the fact that that kind of elite category this year maybe isn't as fortified as most. Like, this is a year where you could have a 6-10 seed potentially win the whole thing. But, like, in terms of based on Duke's typical quality of play, this is not an elite offense. And that was a very gettable game. But no question, it was just remarkable to see it play out live, because you could almost just feel it. When I thought they were going to get it done was when McAdory set up for that split dodge and fell and, like, turned the ball over. It totally really did feel like there was some karma where it's kind of like, okay, like, UVA's getting the rock back. Let's go do this thing. And just one more small point for any high school coaches listening. I cannot get over the fact that Duke called timeout and had McAdory stand at the midfield line. This is at the end of regulation for like 30 seconds, and then dodge with 17 seconds left on the clock. Just based on, like, efficiency numbers with shooting percentage, you want to give your primary ball carrier at least two dodges. Like, you want to be able to run whatever you want. And if you miss the net or, like, bang a pipe, you can re-dodge. right? So you want to, like, in my opinion, you want to trigger there far quicker. But yeah, it was
the reason I asked that question is I feel like Virginia has to do one of two things, and that's either lean full tilt into we are focused to break this streak, not just generally speaking about their season, lean full in to the Kevin Corrigan method, which is we don't care who our opponent is. We don't care. We like coach always would say, if we win the day, we'll get to the goals and where we need to be. So anytime he was asked about, hey, do you think this is a team that could make a run? He would say, I don't care about that question. We're focusing on practice. Or on the flip side, like,
put a countdown clock in the locker room that counts down 365 days to the next time you get to play.
Just be like, hey, this is the team that doesn't let this number get to 21. And that's their pre-national championship, national championship. Like, it has to go one way or the other because this is just an insane streak.
Yeah, not to call bluff on Corrigan, but I don't think he would go to, like, a Nick Saban game day prep meeting when they're spending 8 hours talking about, like, the backup nickel and, like, the four plays that he comes in for to say, we're just focused on us. Like, it's coach speak. I get it. It's marketing for your own room. But, like, you want to be prepared, right? Like, you want Notre Dame to feel like you can focus on us because we know more about them than they know about us. Like,
I think Nick's point is more so about the every game is the same versus we are willing to acknowledge that there are some games that are different, right? We spent last week talking about Michigan, Ohio State, and I believe it was 2 weeks ago that we were talking about Army, Navy. Those are four programs that allow themselves to say there is a game that matters more than all the others, right? Whereas the majority of the time, programs are not willing to acknowledge that. They want to say we treat every game the same because they all have the same value. And on paper, that's true, but in reality, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. It depends on how you approach your rival. I just want to – the history major in me just wants to provide a little bit more context in terms of how this got started. So in 2003, Virginia won the national championship. I remember this as – what? How old were you in 2003?
10.
Yeah. Virginia wins the national championship. This is the Tillman Johnson playing in the mud at M&T Bank Stadium. Johnny Christmas breaks out. Chris Vitale wins the Torten. Very, like, memorable team. I think that year was probably more remembered for the Hopkins-Virginia semifinal game that was incredibly epic. So then in 2004, this – I would argue that there are very few things that changed – and, like, kind of push forward modern lacrosse more than Dom schedules a trip. They win their opening game in the season against Drexel, and then they go to Denver and Air Force and lose both games. And I remember, like, I don't even know how, but, like, I was in, like, Sunday Mass and somebody mentioned it to me, and I was like, what? Like, that's not possible. And so, because it was, like, pre-internet in Cleveland, or not pre-internet, but you get the point. So anyway, even that year, they beat Duke. So, like, the whole thing was, like, the rivalry hadn't really started, or this streak hadn't started yet. So, in a year when Virginia goes 5-8, they're the first, like, defending national champion that doesn't, you know, defend their championship in, like, an incredibly reasonable way and losing the semifinals or whatever. They still managed to beat Duke that year. The following year. So, Duke also goes 5-8 in 2004. This is Matt Donowski's freshman year. Zach Greer comes in, and they, you know, the 2005 Duke team was kind of like it was like an eye-opener for this sport is not going to be dominated by the five blue bloods that can win national championships. We have this newcomer, and maybe that's going to be the thing that paves the way for other programs that can start to emerge. And I think ultimately, in truth, that's what happened, right? Like, you know, Notre Dame and Denver, Loyola, Albany, these programs follow on the heels of that Duke 2005 team. And that Duke 2005 team beats Virginia 17-2. The following year, Duke's season gets canceled for reasons that everybody listening to this podcast already knows. Virginia goes undefeated and wins the national championship. They don't play that year because Duke's season got canceled before the game actually happened. So that 17-2 game in 2005 is the first of what has subsequently been 19 more regular season meetings. There have been two times in the postseason when Virginia has gotten the better of the Blue Devils. The first was the 2010 ACC tournament, and then much more substantially, and will remain one of the more significant and memorable games of recent memory. But Saturday, May 25th, 2019, NCAA semifinals, Lincoln Financial Field, double overtime. Virginia 13, Duke 12. Virginia goes on to win the national championship in 2019. Just an incredible series of events and just unbelievable. The only other thing about this game that I wanted to mention is that Nick, your boy Abe McGuire, who
my boy
is making a sneaky argument for Defensive Player of the Year. I don't think he would be in my top three vote getters, but he deserves it and certainly deserves to win Shorstick D Media of the Year, if that award exists, which I don't know whether it does. I'm sure you would be opposed to it if it did. So I think, Larkin, to your point about the offensive game plan, one of the things that was so effective was Johnny Hackett as a primary dodger, which I think was what a lot of Virginia fans hoped to see coming to the season. Why we didn't, to the extent that we haven't until Saturday, remains a mystery. But in overtime, first possession, he does a kamikaze dodge from low left, and not only does Patrick Jameson make a really nice matchstick save up high, but McGuire collides with Hackett in the crease. They both kind of crumble. He's in the crease. Like, why it wasn't a free clear, I'm not totally sure, but either way, like, McGuire has to, like, limp off the field, and that's why, in my opinion, Duke fails the clear, because they don't have enough personnel on the field. They end up with two long sticks in between the midline and the offensive zone, and they get stripped in that space. And it was like the function of their substitution due to the injury and everything else that goes on. They get the stop on the save that you mentioned where Schutz is hands free, step down. Not only does Jameson make the save, I mean, this is where if you're a Virginia fan, you start to think about divine intervention, because the ball is loose at his feet and he falls ass first onto the ball, and that's what prevents it from going over the goal line. Of course, Aiden McGuire back in the game. Just an absolute, like, Iron Man, steel horse, whatever term you want to use. So just drama on end. And we got to keep it moving because there's a lot more we got to get to. We have spent a fair amount of time talking about the Atlantic 10 on this podcast. Who we have not spoken about is the Hobart Statesmen, who not only put an incredible showing against St. Bonaventure 2 weeks ago to put themselves in position where if they beat UMass on Friday in the last game of the A10 regular season, would have created a, I believe, three-way tie for third place in the conference standings based at, you know, alongside St. Joe's and UMass, that then would trigger all of the tiebreaker scenarios that would determine who got the third and fourth spot. High Point, who had already beaten UMass and Hobart, was safely in regardless of the outcome of their game against St. Bonaventure on Saturday, because they had three wins banked. Those other three teams were all tied at 2 and 3. Of course, High Point then goes on and loses to St. Bonaventure and gives Randy Murren's team their first league win in 15 tries. They joined the conference 3 years or two, well, 3 seasons ago now, and went 0-5, 0-5, now 1-4. So congrats to the Bonnies. But the crazy part about this is that we are told that Hobart, both staff and players, were of the under the impression or of the opinion that they had qualified for the A10 tournament on the basis of the way that the tiebreakers unfolded, because effectively the way that it was read, and this is a reasonable reading of the tiebreaker criteria, but ultimately not interpreted or determined to be the proper reading, was that it goes to the fourth tiebreaker was goals allowed within the three-team group. Hobart finished third in that slot. However, if you were to read it that after determining the first team that gets siphoned out of that, which would be St. Joe's, then it reverts to the first tiebreaker, which was head-to-head, that leaves UMass and Hobart against each other. And then, obviously, Hobart would get it on the basis of the fact that they had beaten UMass. It turns out that's not the case. The first and second place teams in that fourth tiebreaker are who end up in the third and fourth position, and so as a result, St. Joe's is the 3 seed, UMass is the 4 seed in the A10 tournament. An absolute bummer, a total just a reflection of the fact that these conferences have to take it upon themselves to be proactive in informing all of their members of the tiebreaker scenarios in the week leading up to the games, because there was a situation during the game. UMass closed late, and I don't know if they scored 3 or 4 late goals to then ultimately fall a goal short, but there could have been a scenario in which it would have adjusted Hobart's strategy in order to try to keep the goals allowed down over the course of the game that then would have put him in a different situation had they known how the criteria was going to be implemented. You know, Larkin will go to you because you're probably more lawyerly than Nick in your approach to this. I'm sure that you share my opinion that it's a bummer, but what else can you add in terms of just the absolute insanity of how this whole thing unfolded?
Yeah, that's heartbreaking. I think you did a great job laying it out. It's on the conferences to outline at the beginning of the season and then double down through, like, along the way, in my opinion, to make it very obvious, because the point you made at the end around context for game plan and, like, how you could be in a situation where you need to score a bunch of goals or prevent goals, I think is, you know, hyper important to isolate. And you're just gutted for the guys in the room. Like, ultimately, they beat UMass head-to-head. UMass had a strong team this year. And it also just doesn't feel like a great rule, right? It feels like, you know, some, like, lawyer associates got in a room who have never played the game. And to me, it's, like, very clear that, you know, once you pull a team out of that three-way tie, you should then probably go back up the tranching to head-to-head to kind of settle who gets in the fourth slot. So gutted for Raymond and the fellows, gutted for the Hobart Statesman. And just broadly, like, administrators in this sport just kind of need to get their head out of their ass and do a better job of, like, letting the players play.
We're going to get to it.
Yeah, I'm fired up on that one. But, yeah, I'll stop there.
Nick?
What's insane to me is that, to Larkin's point, A, it wasn't clearly stated, you know, from the beginning of the season. But even more than that is looking at this A-10, looking at the Patriot League and how that's played out, like, as things kind of materialize into a place where this potentially could happen, what an opportunity to prevent this type of confusion. And, like, the onus on the conference to be like, hey, even if we didn't lay it out pretty clearly at the beginning of the year, like, have some sort of communication saying we are headed to a place which might cause some confusion. Here are a couple of the scenarios that have the chance of playing out. And there's nothing that frustrates me more than confusion that exists that could have been easily prevented. And layer that on top of, like, yes, and I'm speaking through a lens of, like, corporate world, you know, bullshit. But these kids are throwing their entire life at this sport. To not have at least an email sent out to some of the coaches saying, we are heading into this weekend, here's where it stands, and just so you know, here's what's going to happen given, you know, option A, B, C, or D. It's just, it's sickening. I can't imagine the heartbreak for the kids. And, you know, I don't know where Larkin stands on it from a few, or from a former athlete, but I at least want to earn the sense of victory, or, you know, have the deserving sense of defeat. And it just kind of sickens me that to feel like you have earned something only for it to be only for it to be taken away. I mean, that's got to be the worst feeling. I've never experienced it because, thank goodness, the higher powers had their shit together. So,
yeah, I don't think there's much more to add. So I'll move on because, again, there's just a ton to get to. And one of the places to move on to is where there could have been a lack of clarity, which is in the Big East. It turns out that Marquette decided, no, we are going to squash all of that lack of clarity. And as opposed to losing by a goal to Denver at home, which they had done in the three prior home meetings in 23, 21, and 2019, they put a hurting on the Pioneers and really, you know, send Denver into their offseason with a disappointing 10-6 loss to Providence at home 2 weeks ago, and then an 18-11 loss to Marquette. And the reason that this is even more salt in the wound is that because Denver is an affiliate in the Big East, and obviously geographically that creates a little bit of challenges from travel standpoint, they've predetermined the host of this conference tournament. And it just so happens the Peter Barton Stadium in Denver, Colorado is Ooh. Hosting a Big East tournament that the Pioneers Ooh. Will not be participating in. Jake Ooh. Richard, first year head coach. I don't know if you guys saw the clip of that locker room celebration when he came in, but the purity of joy in his eyes when he got an opportunity to celebrate with his group, and the way in which he pulled some of his colleagues, administrators in to get doused with him was incredible. And I should add that they're not the only neutral site host that will not be participating in this weekend's conference tournament, as Michigan is hosting the Big Ten semifinals and finals, and the Wolverines were eliminated by Rutgers in the Big Ten quarterfinal this past weekend as well. Nick, you're the Denver native. What's your thought on bringing Georgetown, Providence, Villanova, and Marquette to play in front of a really, I mean, that's just a robust lacrosse group. The everybody knows that the lacrosse capital of the West appreciates good ball, and you don't need Daniel Boone on your hat in order to be celebrating the Big East semifinals on Thursday.
My goodness, if there is not something, I mean, best bet in lacrosse right now is a futures for Denver to make the Final Four next year. Because if I'm a player and I'm a junior through a freshman, I am so pissed off that not only did we, you know, make a run to the Final Four last year, but, you know, it's kind of an overused joke. The fall off of Denver needs to be studied. It might actually need to be studied, because looking at the Big East in general, I thought that Denver would be a shoo-in, and I still think that they're one of the best teams, and they just came out and essentially took a dump against Providence and Marquette.
Well, and after beating Georgetown 7-3 and beating Duke earlier in the season. And one of the things that I just want to add is, like, you know, we're getting to the point where in some – it's like my nephew's a freshman at Ohio State. Like, he's already home. His finals are over. That's not the case at Denver. They're on quarters and they go into June, which is usually awesome, because it means if you, for instance, win the national championship, you get to celebrate with your classmates on campus for like almost a month. Or it means that if you miss out on the conference tournament that you were predetermined to be hosting, four of your you know, arch nemeses are coming to your campus in order to play games on your field while you sit on the berm and catch a suntan.
And I'll throw out an opinion, and I'll leave it as an opinion that's ready to be disagreed with. And again, to use an overused trope, I'm like, the college lacrosse world, and I'm as big a Denver hater as that exists. You know, Mike Reese and Westberg, man, those guys suck, even though they're two of my best friends. I just choose interesting friends. But the college lacrosse world landscape is objectively better when Denver's good. And I'll only throw a handful of teams into that overused trope. And usually it's just, you know, Denver, Utah, you know, and choose your Richmond, Jacksonville, High Point. So not only is it a huge bummer, particularly for the Denver seniors, but now that Denver's out of the landscape, like, that's a team that I thought could clip a significantly better resume. Or if they snuck their way in, that would be a first-round matchup that I would have wanted to avoid. So as much as I want to dogpile on Denver and, you know, the terrible alumni that they produce that happen to be some of my dear friends, it's just a bummer, and I'm more sad about it than I am ready to dogpile.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is I think the Big East is also pretty bad this year. So I think the shock of Denver's removal from the top end of that table in a year in which, like, gun to head, you think that they should roll Marquette, Nova, PC, and St. John's. Like, maybe one of those ends up in a dogfight. But, like, I honestly just think the culture alone at Denver, building off the Tierney Foundation, Final Four run last year, like, that's a senior leadership group that's used to winning and expects to win when they get on a plane to go to Marquette. And there's real power in that. There's leverage. So it's definitely, you know, there's alarm bells going off in Brownie's office right now, and I'm sure he's going to get back in the lab. You know, and I really agree with Nick's point that, to me, Denver and or Georgetown were the classic, fairly lukewarm to mediocre resume, but a first-round game that you realistically wanted to avoid. Like, that's not a team you want coming in if you're a 2-3-4 seed in comparison to some of the other alternatives. But it credit to Jake Richard. And that when you hire a former player who's, like, poured his heart and soul into an upstart program and who's young enough to really be friends with the guys, like, the one thing you're definitely going to get is you're going to get a great room. Like, the culture in the room is going to be what you saw in that video, Terry. And what you obviously risk is that he had never been, he was a first time head coach, and he, you know, he hasn't, you know, been through the ringer of like running a program. But happy for him. And I would actually put Marquette in that bucket, Nick, of it'd be good for the sport if Marquette got good. Cause I think it potentially opens the door for other programs out West to consider it. So, credit to him.
A lot of these narratives that we've talked about so far have been backward looking. This one is forward looking, although it reared its head again for either the fourth or fifth week in a row. Yesterday in Notre Dame's win over Penn, Nick, we know that you've got to leave, so we'll get you out of here on this one. Can the Fighting Irish win a national championship playing 10 out of 60 minutes over the course of a game?
Apparently.
It might be the right answer.
Everything about that question leads me to say no. And then, you know, looking at how we play UNC and how we play Penn, are we really a good enough team to play 10 minutes of quality lacrosse and be able to come away with a victory? It's been, you know, to use, if you've played lacrosse, you probably have heard a coach say, hey, we've shown moments of brilliance, and now the challenge for this team is to put four quarters together. Apparently not. I mean, I've said that as a coach, and I don't think that it's technically or necessarily true. What I will say is there are things that are giving me hope about Notre Dame's season. It's the same thing that I've said the week before and the week before that and the week before that. Man, when this offense is good, it's good. Man, when this defense is good, it's good. But we got an uphill battle to figure out how to start hot and play sustainable ball. And the final point that I'll leave with, because I got to get going, is kind of to Larkin's point, and I have enough friends in the coaching world to start really solidifying on this opinion. I think there are the legends of the game. You know, you got the Donowskis and the Corrigans, and they've certainly earned their tenure. If I'm looking, and, you know, I'm a mid-tier program that has potential to make a run at some point, I'm hiring the younger, maybe just retired from the PLL, maybe is just kind of making or thinking about an exit. Because the way that I've seen some of these younger players, whether it's Busick, whether it's Richards, even looking at what Crowley's doing late with High Point, I think there's something special, and I think there's a little secret sauce in having a coach that these players maybe grew up watching, maybe didn't, but in the back of their mind kind of know, oh, coach was a baller, I'm gonna sell out for him. So just food for thought, and you know, we'll kind of see. I would love to see a Corrigan-Busick matchup, because sometimes when I would see Corrigan and Tierney, both me and Westberg would be like, hey, coaches, one of you guys is going to have a heart attack. Let's relax here. So with that, I love you guys, and I will talk to you soon.
Love you more, Nick. Before moving on from this one, just want to give a shout out to Matt Jeffrey, who took a hit in front of the crease. One of the weirder injury treatments that I've seen in a really long time. So brought the stretcher out onto the field, very clearly addressing some neck mobility issues. He fell on his stomach. They rolled him over, which suggested that they weren't overly concerned about a spinal issue. His helmet came off during the contact, which seemed to suggest that, you know, perhaps there was some concussion concern, but on replay, it was very clearly he didn't take any direct contact to the head, which of course is not the only way in which you sustain some sort of head injury. But they didn't actually load him onto the stretcher. Instead, they used the neck brace that was part of the stretcher to stabilize his neck. And then in something that I legitimately don't think I've ever seen before in an athletic contest, he walked off the field on his own power. It was just a truly bizarre kind of sequence of events. And again, just, you know, hopeful that that the injury that Matt sustained is not too severe, and maybe even he's able to return to play this year. But Larkin, you know, we're going to talk about some teams whose seasons came to an end when we wrap this one up. So maybe we'll save a little bit of the Penn conversation for that. But anything from the positive end that you saw out of the Quakers in this one that you feel like is a little bit of fuel or ammunition going forward?
Well, I think where I would take this is I think that what we've seen play out is a potential roadmap for how does the Notre Dame upset happen in round one or the quarters. So how do the double defending champs go down? I think what we saw from Penn, and one of the reasons I had it soft-circled as a potential trap game, is if you have a cover one athlete at close defense who can limit CK's leverage creation, like Notre Dame is pedestrian compared to most years in terms of like dynamically drawing slides and creating efficient shot opportunities, specifically like in the first half. Clearly they kind of have like a light switch momentum issue. Cause that's really what we saw play out. Like 41 did a really good job below GLE. Like he was grinding. I thought the broader Penn defense dug in. You know, their short six haven't had a great year. If you go back through their Ivy results, but like they looked solid on film. And it wasn't as if the water pressure was building and like Notre Dame was coming. I mean, they really like looked the part through 30 minutes in that game, on that side of the ball. And they were just being opportunistic on the other end. I mean, ultimately, like they're not a team that's going to, you know, kill you with ball movement. Like they kind of need to isolate shorties and play push pull and like set razors and just hope that one-on-one matchups lead to goals. And it did. They got that pull goal from 43 and Tranny during the 10-man. But, you know, Notre Dame's playing with a very dangerous fire, which is this notion that, like, you can sleepwalk into every matchup and, like, eventually wake up. They certainly have the tournament pedigree and credibility, so in no way am I, like, taking out a margin loan to short their stock. Like, I still think they are clearly one of the 2, 3, 4 favorites just based on the fact that, like, they have that Kavanaugh bloodline and belief in the room. Like, at any moment, 50's going to make a play, and Jake Taylor's kind of been sleeping, and there's still just a ton of upside there, and they have arguably the best defenseman in the college lacrosse. So when you think about what that can do when if you play a UNC or whoever in the quarters and he can, you know, neutralize a Duffy or a Spallina or a Sam King or even a CJ Kirst. So it's just kind of like interesting. I'm sure it's killing Corrigan and Woj and Wellner. And they just, you know, if you're going to ultimately lose the three-peat, you want to do it like firing at all cylinders. And it's kind of one of these strange years where I don't know if we've seen the Irish best.
And I think that what's compelling about the point you just laid out is when you look at this four-game sample, the loss to Notre Dame, the win over Virginia, the win over Carolina, and the win over Penn, because before that it was a demolishing of Duke, right, which doesn't fit into this narrative, to reuse the term, of their, you know, extended struggles that then theoretically get overcome in these short windows of time. So what distinguishes, and I think the reason they lost to Syracuse is because when they went cold, they weren't able to clamp down on Syracuse's offense. And so while both Virginia, Carolina, and Penn were really only able to put up 4 or 5 goals in these droughts for the Notre Dame offense, Syracuse put up 9. And that was the difference, right? And then they also, I think by virtue of when Notre Dame woke up offensively, what that meant for time and score put them in a position where they could then respond, right? Syracuse was the only one that counterpunched once Notre Dame really delivered. And I think that you said it's probably like prompting Wellner to pull his hair out. I don't know that it necessarily is. I mean, I think that the Syracuse game probably is. I think that there are a couple of things that might mitigate that a little bit. Specifically, you know, Sean Light was playing his first game after coming back due to injury. But we talked about that, right? Like, Joey Spallina was not effective because of Sean Light's athletic limitations. He was effective because of the way that he used space. And I think that on a matchup basis, I thought Quint made a good point on the broadcast of calling out the fact that Penn is so big defensively that they are a lot more like Virginia, whereas Carolina is so small defensively that perhaps that was one of those reasons that they were able to kind of, on a lateral quickness basis, make things a little bit more difficult. Ultimately, the thing about the Carolina game that we really fixated on was the decision to invert Jordan Faison and the way in which he became the reliable source for slide creation. You know, they didn't have a reliable source for slide creation that I saw against Penn. It was, you know, Devin McLean shooting, I felt like, was really kind of the difference in terms of the way in which the offense exploded. Yeah, man, it's an important thing to continue to investigate, especially in a week when, for instance, Maryland doesn't play, because, you know, we're talking about national championship contenders, and, you know, figuring out what these games in late May are going to look like is why people listen to this podcast. There are a couple other reasons that people listen to it, and one of them is to criticize the refs, right? Or at least the rules, if not the refs. And there were two huge situations about 20 minutes apart from each other in real time. One that hit a little bit closer to home for you. Brown State falls 11-10 to the Harvard Crimson, losing out on their last chance to win an Ivy League game this season after a fast break opportunity gets waved off when behind the play, a Brown fast break opportunity, to be clear, a Brown subbing player was called for interference, and it was number 18 putting his hand on the back of Sam King, who was between him and Samari Staten. King goes to the ground, and play gets reversed. Harvard, on a second chance opportunity, gets the goal, and ultimately, despite Brown having a couple more opportunities to tie the game, holds on to the win. And then I will let you go in a second here, but after trailing by, I think, five, Syracuse rattles off four goals in a 226 to 41 or 42 second span in the game, so call it a minute 50, and it appeared that they cut the game to one when ultimately Finn Thompson was deemed for having his stick and hand land in the goal mouth after he converted a transition goal that would have cut it to one with about 23 seconds left, maybe something like that. And ultimately, North Carolina was able to kill the clock and secure the win that then, well, it was really at that point just receding in the ACC tournament. But yeah, I mean, I have been on the record as being anti-goalmouth since the goalmouth was added, which was something that happened during the meeting. That wasn't something, the annual NCAA Rules Committee meeting, that wasn't something that folks expected to happen in that scenario heading into that meeting. And I believe it was implemented for the 2019 season, but it might have been 2018. And on top of that, the decision to call interference for a sub box collision in a tie game with less than 2 minutes to play was one of the more head scratching that I've seen in a long time. So those are my 2 points. And with that, I cede the floor.
I'll do goal mouth first because it's slightly more tame in terms of my personal passion and blood pressure. But I think like we need to get back to first principles as a sport and make a decision on like, is the goalie actually at risk, right? Even in a scenario in which you have Chris Kavanaugh moving a billion miles an hour, okay, headed towards the goal mouth, the launch angle when they leave their feet is not that of a base runner in baseball who's like intentionally trying to run through the center of the chest of a catcher to like dislodge the ball in a scenario in which the ball beats him to the plate. Like, even when the rule was different, even in indoor lacrosse, even when it's legal, like they are almost always intentionally trying to avoid the goalie to increase their leverage. So like the physics of how much net they see increases. Like that's just a fact. And I also think we're like solving for something that at its core isn't really there. Like I think that goalies are elite athletes. They work out with us. Like their knees are in great shape. I'm not really worried about them. Like I think they can handle themselves. And I think that candidly, they'd be like insulted by this notion that they're like, they need to be bubble wrapped. But even more than that, back to first principles, the greatest thing we have as a sport is kind of this lightning in a bottle. Momentum builds quickly. It's a game of runs. Like anyone who was watching that game when it was 14-8 Carolina, and then you started to feel the orange build and they score, Finn Thompson scores to make it 14-12. I mean, the dome was about to explode. Like, I was watching in my living room, quite literally, like, leaning forward, like, wow, like, if Mullins wins this next faceoff, like, what's going to happen here? And we're really going to go to review and basically just, like, stop all of that. And if you're a casual fan, you're confused. You're like, why? He's out of the crease. What's this crease inside the crease? His stick's in it. He didn't even come crease, like, come close to the goalie. I mean, it's just disgusting. And I think like people need to understand this notion of like net new fans and building this thing so that we can actually monetize the professional game and like people who do this for a living can make more money. It's not like easy. There's a lot of other sports competing with us and a lot of people who pay like very smart, capable strategic executives who are taking market share from us when we do things such that the refs did in that game. Like that was a clear, just like let it happen. So, you know, I'm not criticizing the actual officials on the field because that is the rule. Kark said it appropriately on the call. Like they just called what the rule is. I want the committee and administrators, whoever lays out the actual ground rules, to just simplify it. You know, obviously take away the goal mouth. I'm anti-goal mouth. Now, this is a call that if it was during like Duke UVA or, you know, UNC Cuse, this would go down as like one of the worst calls in the history of lacrosse. Because of the season Browns had, I'm fundamentally aware that not many people were tuned into this game. They probably thought Harvard were going to roll. But it was quite literally the worst decision by a trail referee and an absolute Bush League play by someone that I've been incredibly, you know, I'm publicly supportive of as one of the 3 to 5 best players in the game. But the nature of this business is I need to call balls and strikes. In the same way that Sidney Crosby is on Mount Rushmore of the National Hockey League, people are very comfortable saying that Sidney Crosby embellished when he entered the NHL at 18, and he had to change that part of his game. He had to stop flopping on hooks and slashes and whatever because there's a law of the jungle. There's a code of conduct in this business, and people need to understand. I am uniquely positioned to talk about the sub box. I played long stick midfield. Like, I quite literally subbed for a living, and you can hate someone as you're subbing, but there is a like respect based on the nature of how dangerous it is at times. People are running in and out full speed. You don't stick your knees out. You don't like, you know, create physical contact near the box. All these different things that go into subbing effectively and like why this sport is fantastic. Okay, what basically happened, just for those who weren't watching, is that I'm just going to say it from the perspective of the official and why he made the call. Officials are human beings, okay? Great players build up sweat equity throughout the course of a season so that if a Dylan Malloy throws his head back because he dodges hard, he never flops, right? A ref, without fail, will notice that and be like, what the hell just happened, right? Sam King's an elite lacrosse player. So when a trail referee whose job it is to count whether Brown, who was clearing, is onside or offside, and to watch for while the primary ball carrying is happening, whether there's any trail penalties, when he sees the best player on the field go horizontal and dive at the sub box, I can understand why he assumes in real time that something really bad happened over there. It was directly in front of where the entire Brown team was. He probably assumed that there was like a massive cross check or whatever it was. And ultimately, it's gamesmanship. It's gamesmanship by King in that it's a decision he made to basically try and sell something. But it's my job now as a media analyst to basically say that's a Bush League play. And karma comes around, and like, I promise you that there's a code in this game. And if this was indoor, you'd be dealing with Jeff Schneider standing over you, and you'd be waking up a week later in the hospital bed. Like, it's not cool, and it sucks for those Brown kids who deserve. Like, going 0-6 in your league is something you carry as a human for the rest of your life, being the senior captain on that team. And, like, the refs need to let the kids play. They need to get out of their own way and let a team decide the outcome. Harvard's good. They could have won the game in overtime. They could have easily gotten a stop and done it themselves. I'm not questioning their credibility. I'm also not questioning Sam King's upside. He's one of the best players in our country. But that was a horseshit call. Made.
The only thing that I want to add is when you are playing point low, meaning you're on the same side of the fast break as the point man, and you are low, you have to stay above the goal line all the time. Because if you catch that ball, you have to be a threat. But more than that, you have to do that when you are the underdog in a tie game with low time. My contention is that call shouldn't have mattered because Brown should have already scored the goal.
Agreed. We found ways to lose lacrosse games this year that make me sick. I mean, people need to understand. I literally went to a bar last night and just sat there staring at the wall. I was so gutted about that call. But Terry's absolutely correct. We had a bunch of chances to win. We played a senior goalie who hasn't started all year. He made a bunch of saves. He played great. It's a rivalry game, and it always is tight. Even when we stink or Harvard's having a down year, it's always 11-10. And, yeah, I'm just gutted for those kids. But you're absolutely correct. We should have scored in training there.
So let's just finish the podcast by talking about a couple of teams whose seasons came to an end, I would argue, mercifully. The Johns Hopkins Blue Jays went to State College and fell by a goal in the Big Ten quarterfinals to the Nittany Lions, who advanced to take on, let's see, who they got. They get Ohio State, right? And then Rutgers gets Maryland. I think that's right, because I just can't remember whether they reseed or not. The Loyola Greyhounds fell to the Army Black Knights, and the Navy Midshipmen beat the Bucknell Bison, which I believe were the only two factors that were necessary in order for Loyola to miss the Patriot League tournament. We already mentioned Virginia's season is over, having finished below 500 and not being eligible for NCAA tournament selection. Penn is out of the Ivy League tournament as well. The Yale Bulldogs, who did not put in a yeoman's effort against the Princeton Tigers in Princeton on Saturday, their season is not over. You mentioned that they have the Cornell Big Red as the four seed. If you haven't read it, I believe it was 2011, I wrote an article about how the creation of the Ivy League tournament reinvented Yale's program. There is an optimistic side of me that says that Andy Shea's squad has them right where they want them. I don't actually believe that. So, Larkin, your thoughts on the Blue Jays and the Greyhounds to start, and then anything that you would like to add about the Cavaliers and the Quakers? I guess
it's
the Tigers.
It's a great question.
And the Wolverines at this point.
I mean, to start with Hop, the truth, as we all know, is that, like, so I actually thought they had a great result in the sense that, based on recent film and how beat up they are at attack and at specific ball carrying positions, like, it was very hard to envision a world where they could outscore Penn State. I thought they had a good plan. I think Hop this year is a, you know, 15 to 25 team, right? But this is Johns Hopkins and the bar is really high. So I think the challenge for Pete will be he's going to have to get in the portal and he's going to have to try and find a ball carrier. Like, his entire tenure there, he has not had a, let's call it, first through third team All-American type attackman, where, like, late clock, he's picking it up off the end line. Like, I have confidence that this is going to be a great dodge, you know, with crash follow lanes and some seal action, and, like, we're going to get an efficient shot here. Like, it's kind of been more patchwork, and, you know, he has to attack different matchups in different ways. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that. I can pause there.
No, I totally agree, but I would just say that it speaks to what Jacob Angeles was able to do with the ability that he was, you know, given, or that he has. And, you know, and then what that offense was able to do with Jacob Angeles as their primary initiator, because, you know, they were two, you know, I don't know for sure that both offenses finished in the top 10. I actually don't think they did, but they were in that, you know, 12 through 16 range that, you know, coupled with a number 12 defense, was able to produce a quarterfinal team. And candidly, like, the offense didn't fall off that much this year. It was the defense that fell off. Now, I think your point is well taken, because when the offense was good and when this team was 6-2, Russell Melendez was a huge factor in why. Well, he's not back next year. So the point is, and there isn't a clear incumbent either on the roster or in the incoming freshman class. So on that basis, the question becomes, all right, well, what are the solutions? And candidly, I don't know that there's going to be a clear solution in the portal either. So, right. I don't know.
Right, and I think that's the biggest red flag's the wrong term, but question mark, let's call it. If we're just envisioning this as like a Hopkins booster email thread, I mean, that's what their concern is, right? They have a top 5-10 strength of schedule every year. There's no cupcakes. And what I mean by that is, even outside of Big Ten play, like, Navy, Towson, Loyola, right? They're quote unquote, like, hometown regional rivals. Like, those are hard games. Those are trap games for Hop. That's the biggest game of the season for all three of those teams, other than Army, obviously. But, like, it's tough sledding right now at Homewood, because the goal and the bar is so damn high for that program that, even when any lacrosse, you know, anyone who's knowledgeable about the sport, like, watches that game, they're like, hey, this is a well-executed game plan, right? But they lost to Penn State. And Where do we go from here? And it's kind of like it's going to become this kind of ongoing thing. And really, this is just a broader theme that, especially in that league, but you really do need you need to hit on one of these attackmen and just have comfort in that you can go back to the woodshed and the whiteboard and say, hey, this is like he's our guy below GLE. Let's build around that. So that would be my main question. So that I'll kind of stop there on Hop. Who should we go to next?
Thoughts on Loyola?
So I actually give Toomey and the staff a ton of credit for how they surged late. Like it, I mean, at one point it was 0-8, 1-9. And the way in which they did it, where they started scoring and there was a little bit of juice back in the room, gives me some real hope that they can hit the summer hard here. But here's the great news for Loyola. It's basically the inverse argument I just made for Hop. There's always a path in the Patriot League because there are league wins in there every season that you can rattle off. Like you're going to get a Lehigh, Lafayette, Holy Cross, whoever it may be, that if you're even an okay, if you're a B-minus Loyola team, right, you should handle. So really it goes back to like blocking and tackling of, hey, you know, we're probably going to need to think about a potential staff shakeup. I'm not putting words in Charlie's mouth, but that's like, those are three very credible tenured people. In no way am I suggesting that any of them can't coach ball, but you do have to just reconsider all options. And I think in particular, probably the one that he'll have to think about is like recruiting is a young man's game. You know, you're out grinding on the road and you're also trying to connect with 14 to 18 year olds. Like it's, you know, if you're not like my father doesn't even know how to like download TikTok, let alone like how it works. Right. Other than just like as an investor. So the point is that there is like a generational gap and I'm sure he'll think about that. Will he actually do anything? I'm in no way trying to put words in his mouth. Ultimately, he's a national championship coach. He has a ton of goodwill, I'm assuming, with that athletic director. I don't know personally, but I'd expect just, you know, some potential, you know, in-house moves, maybe like a new strength coach. Maybe they flip sides of the field where they come out of the tunnel, like things of that nature.
So I obviously know the program very well. You know, just want to point out a couple things, and this isn't meant to make excuses, but 1-6 in one goal games. We know that is not, you know, it's turnover luck in the NFL, right? If it goes one way one year, it's almost certainly going to go the other way the following year. They don't graduate of their top 9 scorers. They one is departing. So their top 8 scorers are all returning. Matthew Minicus is the star. And to your point about strength coaches, and this is true for all these teams, you know, the correlation between health and success is really, really high. That being said, there are a lot of good teams that have had serious injuries as well. So I don't think that you can use a lack of health as an excuse, but I do think that when you are injured and you lose games ostensibly as a result, you have to examine specifically with soft tissue injuries and overuse injuries, what about these are preventable? What could we have done that would have prevented this? Certainly there's something probably that you can do with ACLs. There's not much you can do about concussions. Nothing you can probably do about broken bones. But you got to avoid the calves, the hamstrings, you know, the disc injuries as much as possible. And being able to train through them and train around them are huge parts of being able to do that. So, yeah, I think that there's you know, another time for a conversation about staff shakeups. I think there's a lot of built-in improvement with the Greyhounds. But ultimately, one of the mitigating factors in that 1-6 and one-goal games is that the standard for this program is that you're not playing one-goal games against Providence and Lafayette, right? So, you know, it goes beyond that in terms of you know, what they need to do, how good they need to be. And you know, again, like we've talked about some of the tropes, some of the, you know, things that are kind of trite. They faced off better than I thought they were going to this year. They got better goalie play than I thought they were going to this year. So sometimes, you know, I think that's probably the case with Denver, right? They were facing off at 45%. They cleared at 80%. You're like, all right, we clean up those two things. Like all of a sudden, you know, some of these results flip the other way. It's like, sure, but you got to do it, right? Like you can't just, it's not just enough to identify the issue. You have to enact and create the solution. And so I think that's kind of where I sit. There's been a lot And you know, you're going to have a senior laden group next year. And so if you're Loyola, it's got to be a significant bounce back in a meaningful way. All right, man. Any final thoughts for this weekend of college lacrosse? The penultimate weekend of the regular season? I suppose you could call it the ultimate weekend because now it's only conference tournament games. But I still do consider the conference tournament to be pre-postseason. Thoughts?
I've got on one that falls fairly close to my heart, and it's the women's lacrosse bracket. So the majority of listeners to this podcast...
Before you go there, I want to give you the final word. But so this falls into the goalmouth category of I knew it was a terrible idea when it was enacted, and it undid a lot of progress. Women's lacrosse games cannot last 2 hours and 50 minutes. The volume of reviews and the speed of the reviews is killing what is otherwise a very compelling sport that has become more compelling. Your thoughts on the women's bracket?
Well, let me just touch on that as well, because I'm passionate about that one. They got to let the girls play. The green cards in between the 30s, all this nonsense of, like, bumping. These are elite athletes. Like, they're not actually going to get hurt. Take away the review, all that good stuff. Take down the fouls. Let the, you know, the athletes decide. So, basically, the specific point I want to make is the men's game, because of the lack of growth west of the Mississippi, has really only had to deal with the specific issue that I want to call out, which is cost mitigation for placing the non-seeded teams. They only have to deal with it when, like, Denver or Notre Dame fall in that category, right? Other than that, there really aren't consistent contenders, let's call it, for NCAA eligibility coming from, you know, outside of the Amtrak corridor. People are within bus length, really, of Johns Hopkins, most of the programs. The women's bracket is not that way. There's far more, obviously, programs in the Western United States, and there's far more, you know, eligible NCAA because the bracket is bigger, because obviously, as we all know, you know, it's like a yield percentage where the amount of men's lacrosse teams impacts whether it can ever go from like 16 teams to 32, right? So you need to grow the amount of programs that play to ever grow the bracket. So in the women's, you know, there are years in which you'll have like a Northwestern, Notre Dame, Stanford, USC, Colorado, right? There's all these different teams, Oregon, you name it, okay? And I had never really dug into this until I started affiliating myself with Stanford Women's Lacrosse. And now I'm extremely passionate based on where we fall. You know, as of right now, we're like 7 in the RPI, 9 in strength of schedule. We're very much in consideration for like a 6, 7, 8 seed, or we could then travel. And if we travel, the implications of that in the women's game is they are going to stuff us in Evanston to play the Wildcats, because that is what mitigates cost. And I didn't really realize the consistency at which women's lacrosse teams that earn, let's call it, like 8 to 14 in RPI, get absolutely hosed on an annual basis with the first round matchups they get, because quite literally the committee is just like back solving for what is the cheapest path, right? So it's a massive advantage if you are Princeton or Yale or Hop or Maryland this year, versus you're the Stanford Cardinal. Because if you're the Stanford Cardinal, the you know, NCAA needs to pay for three teams to fly out here and the lodging and everything that comes with it. So that's a long-winded rant of just to say that, like, we as a sport, I think, need to find a way to, like, create merit and elevate the great teams to kind of get the path that they've earned. So I just wish the NCAA, which is, like, a disaster of an organization to begin with, would solve this and would solve it for all the non-revenue sports. And I know that's a big ask, and I'm not suggesting I have a solution, but I also want Kathy Reese, who's on the regional committee, to know that I am watching what happens here, and I think our case is pretty damn strong for a 7-8 seed, and I will be holding that regional committee accountable. I'll say that.
It's a good note to end on. Larkin Kemp, as always, appreciate your time on the Tailgate Podcast. We'll be back next week. We got more and more to talk about. We can only hope that the slate is as good as it was. I've spoken at numerous times throughout this year that this Thursday is the best day of college lacrosse. This past Friday was sneaky competitive in that, but I still actually, I don't think it holds a candle. We've got games that start from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern start times. It is a full day of lacrosse, and can't wait to talk about it next week.
See you then. Can't wait.